Modern smartphones are sleek and thin, but they're also fragile and expensive. If you're really careful, you may use it until you're ready to upgrade without shattering the glass. But if you look around, you'll see most phones wrapped in a case for protection. Our personal data is even more valuable than the device it's stored on, and it deserves just as much protection. The work that I do requires me to travel a lot, which means I'm frequently connected to unfamiliar networks. Nefarious hackers can make up to $1,000 selling the data of each of their victims on the dark web, and there are cheap hardware and software tools readily available that let even a smart middle schooler snatch your data without you even noticing. A virtual private network, or VPN, like ExpressVPN, creates a secure, encrypted tunnel between your devices and the servers that you're transmitting data to and from. When you're sitting at the airport gate area, or airline lounge, or even your hotel room, those Wi-Fi networks aren't secure. Your bits are flying through the air, and whether you're checking your bank account balance, sending data to a client, or just checking your email, bad actors can snatch up your usernames, passwords, and everything else you send and receive if it's not encrypted. The layers of security used by ExpressVPN would take over a billion years to expose by bad guys with some of the most powerful supercomputers. ExpressVPN trusted server technology also runs each session in memory in a unique virtual space that is wiped clean as you end your session, with none of your data ever written to a hard drive, so there's no residue for anyone to recover about what you were doing after the fact. ExpressVPN runs on almost all devices, including Windows, Mac, iOS, Linux, Android, streaming devices like Chromecast, Roku, Fire Stick, and Apple TV, and there's also a Chrome browser extension. It's super simple to use. Once you install ExpressVPN, it's one click to establish a secure encrypted tunnel with servers in 105 countries around the world. I've personally been paying for and using ExpressVPN for years on all of my personal devices. When I first started using VPNs for work more than 20 years ago, they were often slow and unstable and had to be restarted frequently. But with ExpressVPN, data speeds are virtually unchanged from running fully exposed, so you can just turn the VPN on and leave it on. I often get materials from clients and companies that are under embargo or NDA, and if it leaks out, I can get into some trouble. But even if I just wanted to reach back to my personal server to grab some files, check my email, or watch something that's only available on one of my streaming services at home while I'm out of the country, ExpressVPN lets me do it all securely. Your data is valuable. Don't let bad actors steal it and potentially misuse it. Secure your online data today by visiting expressvpn.com/wheelbearings. That's expressvpn.com/wheelbearings. And you can get an extra 3 months free when you sign up. Expressvpn.com/wheelbearings. And thanks to ExpressVPN for supporting Wheelbearings.
This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
This is Wheel Bearings. I'm Dan Roth from Forbes.
I'm Sam Abual Samad from Guidehouse Insights.
And I'm Rebecca Lindland from Rebecca Drives.
All right, let's get to it. We're driving. So, Sam, what have you been in?
I got to spend a week with a Lexus LC500 convertible.
Sounds tough.
Boy, is that a lovely, lovely car. when I've talked previously about the coupe in both its V8 as well as its hybrid forms, the term I use to describe it, this is a classic grand touring car. Despite its track prowess, and it actually absolutely has prowess on the track. I've driven it at Road America. This is a grand touring machine. This is not a super sports car. It's a GT in the classic sense, like the old Ferrari Daytonas and, basically most of the front engine Ferraris, Aston Martins, that sort of car. So it's got a mix of, high performance and luxury. It's really something that's designed, for two people to travel long distances at high speed in great comfort. which is, you know, exactly what this convertible is great at. And, you know, and I emphasize that to people. It has two back seats. It has seatbelts back there. There is absolutely no logical reason whatsoever why Lexus should be putting those in there. And I think any manufacturer that does this is just, they're being ridiculous. Just stop. Don't bother with the back seats in these cars anymore. The LC, especially in the convertible, you know, I'm 5'11" with the seat in my, you know, proper position. There is no room for legs behind me. But as a two-seater, it's fabulous. It's big and beautiful, and very comfortable to sit in, with the top up. You know, the it's fully lined. It's surprisingly quiet, but you can still hear the exhaust note in it. Full power top. You know, it's got this fancy mechanism where the rear deck lifts up, and the back part of the top lifts, folds up, and the rear deck lifts up, and the whole thing folds down, and the thing goes down. It's an engineering wonder. As the temperature was getting colder while I had it, when you turn on the heat, it's got little heater vents below the headrest, you know, so it's blowing warm air on the back of your neck while you're driving. There's relatively little buffeting, if you put the windows up. Even with the windows down, it's relatively calm in there. There is a wind blocker that was in the trunk that I didn't bother to try to install, because you frankly don't really need it. And it's a fantastic car. You know, there's just one fundamental flaw with this car: the Lexus trackpad. It is atrocious. It is what it is. You know, we've complained about it. You know, we don't need to beat that dead horse again. It's got lots of power from that V8 engine. One other, I guess, you know, related flaw to that though, I found that when I was driving with the top down, and the sun either up high above me or a little bit behind me, the screen also basically was completely washed out. There is a bit of a hood over the screen. With the top up, it's fine, but with the top down, you really, you know, when the sun is behind you, you can't really see the screen at all. Strangely enough, I was able to see the heads up display, which was good, even with my polarized sunglasses on. And slight tangent, I was on a tech talk call with some folks from Continental last week. And they were talking about next generation HMIs, human machine interfaces, and things like augmented reality heads up displays, and learned something interesting from that. You know, we've complained vociferously over the years about a lot of cars, particularly German cars with heads up displays, that fade to nothing when you're wearing polarized sunglasses. And it turns out that part of the reason why German automakers in particular never really paid much attention to that until recently. Apparently Europeans don't wear polarized sunglasses. They wear sunglasses that are not polarized.
Why would you do that?
I have no idea.
Right?
Polarized sunglasses are like the best.
Exactly. if you've got a German car with a HUD and the display disappears when you put on polarized sunglasses, that's why, because they never really looked at it. That's changing now. Newer generation HUDs are starting to work better with polarized sunglasses, even from German manufacturers. But that's, you know, an aside. But as far as the LC500 goes, it was fantastic. You know, I love the coupe and I love the convertible version even more.
What has happened to Lexus? They're making these great GT cars in a time when the passion and appetite for GT cars has really waned. Why could they not have done this 20 years ago when they were constantly dinged for making boring cars?
I know. They were selling cars, you know, hand over fist 20 years ago. They couldn't sell RXs fast enough.
Well, I mean, I guess they did make the SC300, 400 and the SC430 that was really, really strange, but I don't know. This seems like they finally got their act together just in time for nobody to care.
Yeah. I think the logic is that because, I mean, they have been a baby boomer brand. I think the logic is that baby boomers are moving into retirement now. And so they'll want to have this beautiful, you know, empty nester baby boomers will want to have this beautiful grand touring sedan or a convertible, you know, with this great driving experience. But the reality is that the car's 110 to 12,000, right? It's
this one was $111,920, including the $1,025 delivery charge.
Yeah. So that's pricey. Baby boomers are not retiring as they had hoped
ever.
To in
They're
many
not
cases.
Ever.
Right? So
They're never gonna die.
You know, I saw one of our colleagues wrote a great headline. It was like, you know, the LC500, the best sport car that nobody will buy. You know, I don't think that Lexus has really adapted to the demographics in an appropriate way. Like retire, you know, again, like baby boomers who are retiring, very few of them, if they can afford to buy that car, but they're still very active in their grandchildren's lives. They're still very active in, you know, if they are retired, they're not abandoning their families per se, you know, and just going to a retirement community in Arizona, never to be seen again. So I think this is part of it. And again, if you're spending that kind of money on a vehicle, this is not your only car. So, but I do feel like, you know, that they maybe have misunderstood the marketplace a little bit, because it's an incredibly beautiful car. But I wonder sometimes if it would have been almost better as a Toyota, in that, you know, at least Toyota has that, you know, when you think about like the Supra, there's a track appeal there. There's a sportiness and maybe not making it $100,000+. I don't know. It's such a good vehicle. It shows what Lexus is capable of, but you're absolutely right, Dan. It's really not. Who is that buyer? Who are they?
Well, that's my question. You know, it's no more expensive than an 8 Series or an S, you know, the S Class equivalent, but it's also not an 8 Series or an S Class. Well, you know, like,
I mean,
and when you
if I was looking at this, I would, you know, I would look at this and look at an 8 Series, and you know, certainly based on the way it looks, I would probably go for this. You know, go for the Lexus over the 8 Series. You know,
I think,
and it certainly
only
drives great.
Yeah, the only thing that would really, on a personal level, I think the only thing that would really make me choose the 8 Series over the Lexus would be the infotainment. You know, the 8 Series, it's a great car, but it's a lot. You know, this seems, you know, it's still the Lexus is still very, you know, stylish. It stands out, but it's more of a grand tourer. It's a little less edgy. Uh-huh. In the right ways. But you know, I almost wonder if this would have more success if it had you know, partial hybrid or EV option. But I don't know. I mean, I think that
the coupe is available as a hybrid. So you can get and it wouldn't surprise me if they did a hybrid version of the convertible at some point.
But the 8 Series is a very different, I feel like the driving experience in the 8 Series, that is all about passion and engagement and I mean, Dan, I think you know, Sam, you're right. It's a grand touring. The LC500 is a grand touring, you know, experience, whereas the 8 Series is still like, I mean, that's a much tighter suspension.
I would say the 8 is very much a GT as well.
I don't know. I found it to be more fiery and
it's got a much more forward, much more sporty personality, or at least it can, depending on how it's equipped and how you know, which modes you select. So.
Right. Exactly. So no, I mean, but and Sam, I'd love to see your pictures of the LC500 because it is just gorgeous, and I bet your pictures make it even better.
Thanks. It was definitely a fun week to spend with that. And, you know, even without being able to see the screen, you know, it was fine because I was looking down the road anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I took it out, you know, around some of the back roads around here, you know, such as they are, and just had a lovely time with it. So what about you, Rebecca? What'd you have?
So I had the 2020 Hyundai Ioniq Electric. This is the Ioniq comes in three different powertrains. There's a hybrid version with a gas engine. There's a PHEV version, so the plug-in hybrid version. And then this one was the all-electric version. And I have to say, I was really excited to get in it because I felt like I had such a good experience with the Hyundai Kona EV that I thought, oh, good, I can't wait to try this. This is it's a four-door hatchback, so it's not a quote utility vehicle, but of course we love hatchbacks because they're still very functional. So I was really pleased. I was like, okay, great, this is a fantastic opportunity for comparison, but it wasn't the same. It was definitely not the same. I mean, the Ioniq has it's got 100 kilowatt battery, 134 horsepower, electric motor. It's and you really feel it. Like it is not nearly as I don't want to say powerful, but as engaging, really.
Well, it's not Kona, as powerful.
It's not as powerful, right? Yeah. The Kona has 150 kilowatt, 201 horsepower. There's definitely a difference. And so what I kind of took my short, cheap takeaway is, you know, not all electric vehicles are created equal. And the Ioniq, it's less expensive for sure. So if that's a priority for you, then the Ioniq makes sense. It doesn't have nearly as much range. It maxed out at 170. The Kona maxes out at about 258. So it's a very different vehicle and the pricing reflects that. So it's appropriate. So, you know, if you're constrained by budget and you have a very specific budget that you're looking for, you can get into the Ioniq for high 20s after the federal tax credit. The other thing that was interesting to me was that the Kona is available in 11 states, but the Ioniq's only available in 10. And I didn't know why that was. I don't know if that's just an anomaly on the website, but that was kind of, I want to explore that a little bit more.
Yeah, I mean, typically Hyundai's been selling their plug-ins only in the ZEV states.
Right.
And I'm not sure why there would be a difference between the Kona and the Ioniq.
I know.
It may just be something that there might be an error on the website.
Right. That's what I was thinking too. I just picked it up. I looked at it about an hour ago before we came on the air. So I want to delve into that a little bit more. But, you know, it's what I took away from it was that, you know, if you don't want a utility, if you do still want an EV, this is a priority for you, then this is a great first experience with an EV. It has the same type of charging. It's on a 220 volt, you can get 6 hours for a full charge. DC fast charge, you've got about an hour, about 45 to 50 minutes, 55 minutes for an 80% charge. So, you know, a lot of the ownership experience is the same. I plugged it into mine overnight and it charged up just fine. So it's, you know, it's good. It's just, I was disappointed in the lack of engagement that I had with the vehicle. It felt like I was driving an inexpensive compact sedan as opposed to driving the future.
Well, but you were.
Well, exactly. But I was hoping that the EV would have more engagement than it did. You know, that instant torque that I loved in the Kona really just wasn't there as much because it's a different, the specifications are different on it. So,
right. Well, you know, when Hyundai launched the Ioniq a few years ago, you know, they talked about this. You know, we asked them because it, you know, it came out not long after, or pretty close to the same time as the Bolt. And, you know, we asked them, you know, why its range was so short. And in fact, it got better for 2020. They did a mid-cycle update this year,
right,
which boosted the battery up to 38 kilowatt hours from 27. and took the range from about 130 miles, 127 miles, I think, to 170. We asked them why they did that. And the explanation they gave at the time was, you know, they, and this is actually a very similar explanation to what Honda gave for the Clarity Electric. You know, they were going for optimal efficiency. So they were trying to find the right best balance of efficiency and range, you know, to give a usable range, but really to focus on efficiency. Because, you know, when you go to a higher capacity battery with more range, you know, it's going to be heavier, which is going to hurt your efficiency. And so they really focused on that efficiency part of it, you know, to the detriment of range, you know, and depending on your use case, you know, what your lifestyle is, you know, the 127 or even 170 miles might be more than adequate. And I think that if you're, you know, for example, if you're in the market for something like, you know, the standard Nissan Leaf, not the Plus, you know, that one's only got 150 miles of range. You know, here you have 170. I think that, to be honest, I think the interior of this is, you know, probably a little better than the Leaf. You know, arguably the design, I think, is better than the Leaf. You know, it's certainly a very practical car. You know, it's got lots of cargo space and room. It's got, you know, the Ioniq has more passenger space, particularly in the back seat, than the Kona does. So, you know, if what you're looking for is an EV, an affordable EV that, you know, can carry four or five people more comfortably than you can in the Kona, you know, this may be a better choice for you than the Kona.
Yeah. But, I mean, yeah, I think
you're right. The Kona is a lot more fun to drive.
Right. I think that was my, you know, I was coming off of that Kona, so excited about it. And then it was kind of like, wah, wah, wah. So, you know, but with all that being said, and you're absolutely right, Sam, like this is, it's a different consumer. It's a different clientele potentially. I think this is a great vehicle if you are still commuting, you know, within, and that 170 is going to give you a couple of days worth of range. I think that it's a great around town. I did have a better experience. I was so thankful for the listener who mentioned the paddle shifters and the regenerative braking, because I was able to engage that and play around with that and have a better experience when it comes to the regenerative braking and the one pedal driving and such. So thank you for that pro tip, because that was fun to play with. So
yeah, I was going to ask you about that.
Yeah.
And I was also going to ask you, so did you have a chance to try the fast charging, or
I didn't need to. All of our listeners, they're our family too, but I ended up having to spend a couple of days with my mom, which I'm very thankful for, but I didn't get a chance to drive it as much as I would have liked to have done. So the person that normally takes care of her wasn't able to come. So I was commissioned, which is fine. But so yeah. I wanted to, I had every intention, because it did have a charge point card with it for the opportunity to charge it. So I apologize to my, you know, to our audience here that I didn't get a chance to do the fast charging, but that is certainly on my list of things to do with the next EV.
And when you charged it at home, it's still just 110, or did you weasel?
I just did 110. So my plan is to get us, you know, a level two charger at some point, but no, I just did 110, just plugged it in, and it was great overnight and didn't have any problems with it. So, you know, there's that 170 range. I mean, the other thing that I found was, when I first, you know, even just a couple of months ago, I remember getting an EV and being like, oh shoot, that's only 100 miles. Yikes. But you get used to it so quickly. Yeah. I'm like, oh good, 100 miles. Great. I'm not driving 100 miles today. Like, it's funny how you can kind of, you know, you can get into, that range anxiety disappears very quickly once you start using the vehicle and once you start driving with it. And again, you know, think about, even though 110 is not ideal, the trickle charging, it can take a long time. But, you know, I got home at 7 o'clock one night. I plugged it in. I'm not leaving my house at 7 a.m. You know, I left my house about 9. And so, you know, and yeah, it's kind of a pain to roll up the charger and do all that stuff. But it's not a big deal. Like, it's something that, you know, again, definitely look at putting in a level two charger. If you buy this vehicle or if you lease this vehicle, you're going to set it up for more permanently than we set it up with you know, our 1 week test experience.
Right.
So, but, you know, all that being said, I think the interior is really nice. The SE has an 8-inch touchscreen display. The Limited, which is what I had, bumps that up to a 10.25 touchscreen. And, you know, overall, it's just, it was a very easy vehicle to live with. It's very familiar. It's comfortable. The ergonomics are really nice on it. That infotainment system is great on it. Apple CarPlay, Android Auto, and there's a lot of safety features on it. So, you know, there's a lot of really good things about this vehicle. It's just that it is more of a utilitarian EV experience rather than the more engaging Kona experience that I had. So those were kind of the two big differences. But it's also like $7,000 difference in price too. So
it was cold last week. So how did it do with running like heated seats, heater, that kind of stuff? Did that?
Yeah. So the heated seats were great. You know, again, like they've really have thought this out. So the HVAC, you really don't have to use as much because you've got a nice toasty heated seat.
Yeah. And did you set it? So, cause I played with this and I mentioned it last week with the Bolt. I couldn't figure out how to get it to precondition the interior. I didn't download the app.
So yes, I didn't
probably do that through the app, but
yeah.
Did you do any of that? Like set it up so that it preconditions?
I did not.
Okay.
I've done that in the past. In fact, I did it last year when I had the Kona EV. I set it up. I had some meetings that I had to go to, and it was during a particularly cold week. So I preconditioned it to heat the interior while it was still plugged in, which was great. You know, get in the car. It's already nice and warm. Raising the temperature takes a lot more energy than it does to maintain the temperature.
Right.
And, you know, so, you know, if you do have, you know, an electric vehicle and you live somewhere where it gets cold or hot for that matter, you know,
absolutely,
you know, in the summertime, take advantage of that preconditioning capability that pretty much every modern EV has now. You know, in many cases, you know, if you own the vehicle, you can usually do it through an app. In a lot of cases, like with Hyundai's, you know, they have support for Amazon.
The skills.
That's the word I'm looking for. Yeah. And so if you have Echo devices in your home, you know, you can tell it to warm up your car and, you know, you can set the temperature and just do that with a voice command from inside the house, you know, before you're ready to leave. And you know, a number of other manufacturers are doing that now too. So it's definitely worth taking advantage of that because that heater won't eat nearly as much into your range that way, as it otherwise would.
Yeah. Well, and that was, so it's interesting to sort of compare and contrast your experience with the Ioniq EV. And we're at this point now where there's a lot of choice in EVs.
Yes.
Not as much as I want, but you know, even just among Hyundai and Kia, you could do the Kona that has that, you know, more forward personality that we all love. Or you can do the Ioniq, or there's the Niro. And you can jump out to now other similarly priced EVs like I was driving, which was the Bolt.
And
I really loved the Bolt. And I talked about it last week, and it's funny, after I talked about how GM should put that powertrain in everything and make it available for swaps, that's exactly what they did.
Obviously, they're listening.
Yeah. They want any more good decisions, come to me. Let me know. But they released that Bolt-powered K5 Blazer, which is just super cool. But it's basically the Bolt powertrain. Because the Bolt is a really well-done EV. It's the same thing that you found with the Ioniq. It's easy to live with. It's really pretty simple to use. It's got good space inside. It's great to drive. And it has actually even better range. Its range was like 200, around 250 ish. I used the heater, and that was, you know, kind of prompting my question. Boy, did that range drop. it eats a bit, you know, not anything to cause worry, but it's just, you know, I would take it with a full charge and just go, you know, do 10-mile round trip, and it would have lost quite a bit, which is fine because it has the sort of built-in buffer. But that was interesting to sort of observe. Charging experience wise, so this was the first time I used a charging service. So I got a call from the fleet guys. They said, hey, the Bolt needs to be in Maine tomorrow. Please make sure it's fully charged. And I'm like, oh okay. It's going to take 2 days to fully charge from where it's at on a 110 outlet with, you know, extension cords into the backyard and whatever. So I was like, hang on. It's got a charge point. I think I had a charge point or an EVgo card in it. So locally we have the commuter rail station and they have 1772 chargers there. So I just took it there and put it on a level two, and that reduced the charging time. And so it was really interesting just sort of using that gas station model of charging in a way, like, oh, I need to go refuel the car. Where's the nearest station?
Right. And,
yeah, that experience is not there yet.
Well, and that's what, you know, we talked about this earlier this year. You know, GM's deal with EVgo to install DC fast chargers at places where people are going anyway. I think it sounds like what you were using was level two chargers, 240 yep. volt chargers.
Yep.
You know, they're putting 480 volt chargers or 400 volt chargers, you know, places like grocery stores. You know, so in a half hour, you can be fully charged up, you know, while you're shopping for your groceries.
Right. And that makes a ton of sense because yeah. that was my concern was, this is cool. I'm glad it's here. If it weren't, a global pandemic, I guarantee you I would not have been able to just waltz in there and put the thing on the charger for 4 hours or 5 hours, however long it took. I paid for the parking too, which was like $4. It's not a big deal, but it's still. And the charging was free. So that was nice.
You didn't have a DC fast charger?
No, there was no fast charger. And I don't...
The Bolt supports 50 kilowatt fast 50 charging.
Kilo. Okay. Yeah. So that would have been better. It would have cut it down to a couple of hours to fill it up.
If you were doing it all the way from like near zero, it'd probably take a little more than an hour.
Oh, okay. That's
about an hour and a half. Okay. Actually, one of the listener questions we have later addresses that. So we can come back to that.
Okay. So yeah, that's the experience with the Bolt that I thought was really, it's interesting and varied still, you know, and if you wanted to actually use it, it's good to know that you can, you know, the charge point or chargeway or EVgo, there's a lot of different ways you can find different chargers. When I looked at the charge point site too, I had to know the area as well, because like knowing where they were directing me, I was like, oh, that's not a charger I'm going to be able to use. You know, it's like behind a fence locked in somewhere versus, I knew that these were at the commuter rail station. So
yeah, I think all of that, all of those logistical issues are improving though, you know, with every iteration. I mean, I don't think that, you know, I don't think anybody's kidding themselves. Having an EV is different than having a gas engine. It just is. Yeah. And so, you know, but there is also significant resources that are going towards making that ownership experience more convenient, more seamless, more familiar, if you will. So I think that we've got a long way to go. But I also think, you know, I don't want anyone to interpret our discussion as a criticism of charging because we're using 110 at home. It's they're observations. And, you know, somebody said, you know, please get yourself a level two charger. And I'm like, well,
oh, you know,
and they couch it in such a way that because that's a more realistic ownership experience. I'm like, it's not actually, because a lot of people don't have a place to put a level two charger. Yeah. And, you know, it can be very, very expensive to run.
Well, and if you rent, you don't necessarily have that choice either. There's a lot of people that rent.
Yeah.
Right. Exactly.
And even if you own, you know, in a lot of cities, you know, even single family homes don't necessarily have a driveway and a garage. A lot of people rely on street parking.
Exactly.
And so, you know, having access to public charging somewhere is going to be crucial to making this mainstream.
Right. And I think our experiences are actually more reflective of what is happening today, not necessarily what will happen in the future, but certainly what will happen today. So I think that your experiences, Dan, are really interesting. And again, it's, we're not criticizing. We are, we're just giving our experience. It's not, it's just, this is what we faced when we went to charge. Would a level 2 charger at home fix all that? Sure. But that's not the reality for so many people. And so I think that, you know, you're absolutely right. There's so many choices that we have now, which is really exciting to see. But we still have to, I don't think that the mainstream buyer is totally there yet. And so it's our job to say, this is what your experience is going to be, especially if you don't have a level 2 charger at home, which is why I always preface it. If you can put one in, please do. It'll save yourself a lot of hassle. But right. if you can't, that's not 100% barrier to ownership. Like it really may have even been a while ago when it would take 2, 3, and 4 days to charge this thing. You know, there yeah. are other opportunities out there for charging.
Well, and it was
that's my little rant. Sorry.
No. I mean, I think those were the choices that I made. You know, it was it's nice to have the option available. You know, for me, I'm not using all of its range every day, so I can just pop it on the 110 and it'll top up enough and it'll be fine. But knowing that I really needed it to be fully charged in a short period of time,
right?
I had the option to go plug it into a charger, and we had a pretty lively discussion on Twitter about this a few days ago with some folks, and really it sort of boils down to the charging experience isn't quite there for everyone but Tesla. And one of the smartest things that Tesla has done, and one of the real big values to the company overall, is their charging network, the way it Absolutely. Integrates with the cars, the way you don't have to worry, you know, like is this thing going to have the right plug? Is it going to work? You know, because the cars actually phone home if the supercharger isn't working correctly, and they alert so that they can get repaired. And so the charging network for Tesla is generally, it's widespread, it's super easy to use, it's in good repair.
Most of the time.
So that's all really important. And, you know, like, yeah, I had to go and I had the ChargePoint card or the EVgo card. So that was actually pretty easy. You know, you just hold it up to the kiosk and it unlocks and you just plug it in. So that was interesting to experience as well. But then I had to go fight with the parking, like the parking machine in the parking garage.
Oh, right. Too. So yeah. Like, where you have to put the license plate in. And
right.
Yeah.
I had to do like 2 different transactions, and that one wouldn't take my card because it couldn't read the mag strip and it didn't have a chip reader. And I'm just like, come on. you know, so like, that experience. And that's the thing that, yes, it's all available for you now. You don't have to do, you don't have to buy a Tesla, to have an EV, and, you know, charging is available. It's more charging infrastructure is being built, but it really takes commitment. And as a consumer, like if I had the whole family in the car and we were going somewhere, I would be so livid just having to deal with that frustration. You know, as it was still kind of a pain, and it was like, oh, I'm losing more time on this. And I thought I could just drop it off at the garage and be done. And now, you know, it's just a hassle. So that's got to get better. And I think that that's, you know, part of the reason that people buy Teslas it doesn't have anything to do with the car. It has to do with how easy it is to use. I mean, the car will route you to the supercharger if your route changes. You know, so it takes some of that route planning out of it, and you know that it's going to work and be reliable, and the customer experience is really important. So it just drove home. To be fair,
you know, most EVs do have, you know, it can route you to chargers as well. You know, they have that the chargers and the points of interest in the nav systems. Right. And you know, the process is about to get a whole lot simpler for a lot of people as well. There's a standard called Plug and Charge, which is now being implemented by charging network providers and, you know, the companies that do the back-end stuff of connecting this, which basically, you know, it takes a lot of the friction out. You know, the things you were just describing will go away over, you know, in the coming months and years, because, you know, they're doing things like, you know, essentially one of the things it enables is roaming. You remember, you know, not so many years ago, you know, with your cell phone, you know, you, and if you wandered off somewhere where your particular cell provider did not have a tower, and you know, if you were a Verizon customer and you know suddenly you were making a call through a Sprint tower, you know, you were paying roaming charges, and that has all gone away. You know, they've basically connected all these networks, you know, so that you're no longer paying roaming charges. And that's the sort of thing that's going to happen, that's happening with EVs. You know, the Ford Mustang Mach-E is one of the first that implements this plug and charge standard, you know, through the Ford Pass app that's built into the Sync system, and also through Electrify America and Green Lots. So when you pull up to one of those charging stations and plug in your car, the car will authenticate itself with the charger and the network behind that charger, and it will just automatically bill your Ford Pass account. So you have a credit card, you know, or cards, you know, assign a payment method linked up to your Ford Pass account, and you just go to a station, plug it in, and go. And you don't have to mess around with any of the NFC cards or any of this other nonsense. It'll just work. And you know, that's, you know, we're going to see that happening across the board with new EVs that are coming to market. You know, now that standard has been finalized.
Yeah, and I think that's really one of the sort of final barriers to getting it wider EV adoption. You know, the cars are there, the product is good. It's how you refill the batteries that still needs some work. And this is not a complaint. This is more observations like, okay, this experience, and I'm sure on, you know, in some places it's better than others, and here it wasn't bad. It was just, it took a little bit of head scratching, and as you get used to it, you know, once you do it a couple of times, it becomes much easier. You're not confused by the process, but the first few times it can be confusing. And most people don't go on super long trips with their EVs. So it's really, these are observations, and once it becomes as easy as a gas car or as nearly as easy as a gas car, it's going to be a lot easier to make that switch. It just takes a little while to get there. And I know they're working on it. And you've had to really combine a few different, you know, companies. You know, Tesla is the only company that's sort of, well, not the only, but Tesla's pretty vertically integrated with, you know, they own the charging network and all of that stuff. Ford and GM don't.
So has any manufacturer ever owned a gas station? You know what I mean?
And that's yeah, key. Like, no, they haven't. Right. But those two industries grew up in parallel.
And, absolutely.
And I think we need to mirror that and say EVs and charging, and they will, because they kind of have to, but those industries need to grow in parallel too. So there's a mutual benefit. They all realize it. They're all working on it. So it'll get there. You know, I mean, think about how many different like audio players and music apps and stuff we used to have. And now it's basically you just go to one. You know, so same kind of thing. So I think that's about it for the garage. I don't want to babble anymore about this because we have questions to get to.
Yeah, so we've got quite a few questions actually. Let's start off with actually a question from the last show that we didn't get to, from Gareth Thomas. Gareth asks or says, you know, I really enjoy your show and look forward to each new episode. Thank you, Gareth. However, I'm more of an old car person than a new car person. So I have a couple of historic car sales questions. Is there a good way of finding MSRP information? I presume that he's referring to the original MSRP for old vehicles. I've been able to find a few cars listed here and there, but nothing easily searchable. So for the first part of this, I did do a little digging around, and actually state of Michigan, and I suspect most other states have something similar. Depends on how they charge for their licensing or for, you know, license plates and registration. But state of Michigan, part of the registration fee is based on the original price of the car. So on, and we'll put this link in the show notes, Michigan.gov, there's a link to this particular one is for new car MSRPs from 1987. And they, you know, they have similar documents for other model years. And I picked the 87 because the second part of the question gets into that. But it lists all the original base MSRPs for all the cars that were available in the 1987 model year in the U.S. So the second part of the question is, he has a 1987 Jaguar XJS with the lovely V12. What were its competitors when new? Porsche 930, BMW 635 CSI. What offered similar performance and value? I feel like I'm missing something. While not sold in the U.S., the Ferrari 412 has a lot of the same features, V12 up front, 2+2 seating, and controversial styling. The Ferrari is more powerful and slightly faster than the Jag, but presumably costs quite a bit more than the XJS's $37,000, which brings us back to the cost when new question. So, did a little thinking about this. You know, a couple of ones I think that were clearly more competitive. I don't think the 930 was really a competitor to the XJS. Mm-hmm. No. That was, 911 turbo. 635 CSI, yeah, to some degree. In those days it was still just inline six cylinder only, no V12. But the Mercedes-Benz SEC and SLC from that era, I think, the big coupes were definitely XJS competitors. And of course, the old school Aston Martin V8 and Vantage of that era was another one, although probably a lot more expensive than the Jag. Any thoughts from the two of you?
So the XJS was in production for so long that its competitors changed.
Yeah.
throughout its life. But I think.
Yeah. I mean, it launched in the early 70s and finally went away in the early 90s. So it was about 20 years, I think.
Yeah. I do think that if you want to compare it to a Porsche, the 928 is more.
That's a good one. I forgot that one.
It's competitor. Or, Ferraris. I thought the 412 was sold here, but I was a kid then. So I definitely the Mondial, but that's a different kind of car and a lot more expensive. So I don't know. Rebecca,
And any Ferrari is going to be a lot more expensive to maintain than the Jaguar.
But not necessarily any more problematic.
Well, I was looking.
You're down in Greenwich, all this stuff is like daily drivers down there.
Yeah, exactly. No, I was looking actually to see also because if I've misinterpreted the question, it's part of it is about finding out what the price was on it as well, right?
Yeah. Okay. So I'll put that Michigan website on there.
Yeah, because I was doing some research for something else on Carfax, and they actually had the original MSRP of the vehicle. Now it was newer, so I just did a quick search on. They went back to 2003 for a Jag, and I don't see at quick glance. I don't see the original price on it, but it might be there. I just haven't had a chance to look through, but. Yeah, so I think that there's because Sam, when you put that Michigan website up, I was wondering if there's if there was other more nationwide sites like a Carfax or something. But so anyway, so I'm catching up here. Sorry.
Well, I think I also looked at places like KBB, for example. You know, you can find used car values there, but unfortunately, their listings only go back to early 90s.
Right.
So it doesn't go back quite this far. Other sources, I would check, probably Hagerty.
Yeah, was my first thought too.
That'd be a good one.
For sure. In terms of, what he said, what he comments here, and this may not be a priority at all, but I do think that potentially while the Ferrari, is certainly going to cost more possibly, but it could also increase in value eventually.
But not a Mondial.
Yeah. Well, I guess that's it, right? It depends on which one it is. And the same thing with Aston Martin, but also I think when did Ford buy Aston Martin? Was that in the 90s?
89, I think.
89. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So, so I think that anytime that you're looking at these older vehicles, you have to keep in mind ownership of, you know, who was owning, who owned the brand at the time, because that's going to impact what vehicle they built. You know, Astons were owned by Ford, and I think that that may not have been the ideal.
Well, Jaguar. When did Ford buy Jaguar? Was that 98 as well, or was that?
Yeah,
earlier?
Sometime
it
in
was
that
somewhere
thing.
Around 90.
The whole PAG
90.
Group, yeah, right. The Premium Auto Group.
Was yeah. that within the span of a few years they bought Volvo, Jaguar, and Aston Martin?
Yeah, and Volvo I think was the sort of the last in 98. Yeah. So, I definitely think that the XJS probably has an analog over at Aston, regardless of sort of ownership. You know, they did kind of keep the companies running with their different product lines. You know, and it was an expensive car, but I'm trying to really just conjure up what other sort of GTs there were at that point, because back when it originally debuted, you could have certainly competed with the Jensen Interceptor. Uh-huh. But the Interceptor, I don't think made it into the 80s. Other stuff too, like maybe Bristols, but Bristols are a lot more expensive.
Well,
like,
yeah, and also I think that there is, I mean, there is an upkeep anachronism. Question too, you know, getting, I mean, it's, you know, I think, I don't know, maybe I'm putting my practical hat on too much, but, you know, you can get very, very exotic and you can't find parts for it. You know, so
yeah. Well, the great thing about the Jag is back in the day, like,
yeah. So,
and that's funny when you talk about the sort of increase in value of something like the Ferrari. And I just, you know, I made the flip comment there, right? The Mondial doesn't really appreciate like Ferraris do. Sure. But the XJS has basically got like an anchor tied to its value. Nobody wants those things. They're lovely cars, but they have that reputation as being temperamental and they're not that bad. But people in the 80s and early 90s didn't quite get it, especially the V12s. You know, it was like alien technology. And so the common, very common solution was, well, take that out and put in a 350 with a carburetor, which there was like this company called Jags That Run that like they made kits to do it. And it horrifies me because it's such an inelegant solution. Although the small block is fantastic. You know,
the small block you'll probably end up with better performance, more reliability, and it'll be a hell of a lot cheaper to maintain.
Yeah, but it's not a V12 Jag, you know?
That's true.
and like Bosch fuel injection is not that complicated. People are just lazy about learning it. So yeah, I don't know if we answered that question or just drove around the cul-de-sac.
Yeah. Well, I think Hagerty's a good resource.
Yeah, yeah. And you know, I just pulled up the 85 Mondial in concourse condition. According to Hagerty, it's worth about $40,000.
Yeah. So, well, an XJS, you can get a really nice XJS for like 15.
Yeah, and you know, a tune-up on an 85 Mondial will probably cost you about $20,000 annually.
It's an engine out service. I mean, those Ferraris, like the 308s, the Mondials, and stuff, like a cheap Ferrari is great if you're a DIY person and if you have the space and the patience.
You have a garage and a lift and everything. Yeah.
Because they do, you know, a lot of the stuff is engine out services, but it comes out easy. It's designed to be serviced. It's just,
it's not, you know, it's complex.
Is it designed to be serviced at home, though?
No.
Right.
It all depends on where you live.
You got to have commitment.
Exactly.
All right.
All right. What else? Next one up. Russ Stoffer. Question for you to maybe include in a podcast someday. In the old days, car grills were almost all usually horizontal shapes of some sort, sitting above the front bumper line. There might be a modest louver below the bumper as well. Lately, though, it seems like grills are both larger and often lower or split vertically into one horizontal bit above bumper line and another below or else integrated into the bumper. See the RAV4 as a poster child for the split or dual air and take a look. What's up with that? Do radiators sit lower now? Are radiators larger? Or is it just all styling, etc.?
So I think there's a combination of things going on with the grills. First of all, there's pretty strict pedestrian crash regulations that are dictating the shape of the front of a vehicle. They tend to be more square. But also there's, I don't think that the, and Sam, you're much more qualified to answer this question, but I don't think the functionality of the radiator has changed all that much. But the other thing is that a grill now is also expected to support a whole variety of sensors and cameras and do really multitasking, not just serving as the a functional purpose for the radiator. It's also now suddenly our eyes and ears into what is in front of the vehicle. So I think that there's a combination of things that are going on there, both a design and functionality and a multitasking purpose.
Yeah, I think too, we could totally eliminate the upper portion of the grill. Like, that's mostly just style. And go look at a lot of BMWs. They don't have much opening there. They certainly have active shutters because really all of the air comes from the bottom. Most cars are bottom breathers because that's where the high pressure is on the front. As you push air out of the way, it sort of piles up on that lower part of the body. So you cut a hole there and that goes into the engine compartment. And so most of the air is done from a, you know, scooped up from not too far off the road, foot or two off the road. So we don't, and you saw this with, you know, cars in the 80s, like the Taurus, where they hardly had a grill opening because they didn't need it. They got every, you know, all the cooling air they needed from below. It's mostly a style issue now. And it does sort of allow them to package those sensors and hide them a bit, although they're not doing such a great job hiding them. You know, you can see like Mercedes with this giant plexiglass piece in the middle. Yeah. You know, around. So right. some are more elegant than others at hiding the sensors, but it's mostly a convention at this point to have a grill.
Essentially, what we think of as the traditional grill is all about styling. It has almost nothing to do with functionality anymore. It's all about creating a visual language that identifies this car as a Genesis or a BMW or a Ford or whatever it might be. Even with these massive grills that we have today that, you know, talked about, you know, especially with Genesis and BMW of late, there's usually, you know, as you said, Dan, you know, only a small portion, it's an actual air opening. You know, the rest of it, if you actually look closely, you'll see it's blocked off. There is no airflow through most of that area. You know, I think on the G90, you know, there's a space that's about 12 inches wide by about 4 inches high, you know, that is an actual air opening. Same thing on the latest Ford Explorer. You know, now that, you know, I've seen the new Explorer, you know, as a police vehicle, you know, it's particularly obvious on there, you know, because it's all black. You can see where the opening is. It's a very small opening. There are some exceptions, like, for example, the Shelby GT500. You know, almost all of that area is open because, you know, it's got huge cooling requirements for the engine and the supercharger and everything. But most of the rest of it is blocked off. It's all about design. And as you said, Dan, you know, grab most of the air that does come in is grabbed from down below because you don't want that airflow underneath the car for aerodynamic reasons and you know, minimizing lift and everything. So they try and grab the air from down low, and you know, the rest of it is just closed off. So
yeah, so it's a design. I mean, it's the grill is the face of the vehicle.
All right, next, Joseph Marino. Hi everyone, just picked up a brand new vehicle and has the auto stop start, which shuts the car off when it comes to a complete stop. I'm not sure if I like it or not. It's a little annoying, especially in Boston area stop and go traffic. What are your feelings on it? Would love to get your feedback. Thanks. Keep up the great show, Joe.
All right.
Well, I think it depends on the vehicle because I think almost all stop starts can be turned off, but it's just how hard is that to figure out? Well, that's yeah. So it depends on the vehicle. I'm going to just leave it at that.
Which ones can't you turn off? Because usually you it has been the case that you can shut off.
So it depends. You know, with the EPA, with the fuel economy ratings, the way the EPA drive cycles are set up, manufacturers don't actually see a whole lot of benefit in the cycle from auto stop start because the car almost never actually comes to a complete stop. So the engine doesn't shut off. real world driving, you get a lot more actual benefit in fuel economy because the car does come to a stop, especially in stop and go driving, which is the whole point. And stop and go driving, you can get up to about, 8 to 10% improvement in fuel economy with auto stop start. So what's happened, EPA, when manufacturers started wanting to put auto stop start in, they went to EPA and said, look, we see the benefit of this, on the European driving cycle, but we don't see it on the EPA cycle. And so EPA gives them an off-cycle, what they call an off-cycle credit. So if you put auto stop start in the vehicle, they will adjust the, when they run the tests to get the actual, raw numbers for fuel efficiency, they make some adjustments to that. And one of the credits that they get, so they'll bump up the fuel economy number by a little bit if you have auto stop start. If a manufacturer puts in a shutoff button, EPA makes an assumption that a certain percentage of customers are going to disable the auto stop start. And so there's not going to be as much real world benefit from it. And so they may give you a 2 or 3% bump in your fuel economy if you number your label number if you have auto stop start with a shutoff button. If you don't put in a shutoff button so that it's forced to do it all the time, they give you more credit. So it depends on the manufacturer. If the manufacturer wants more of a credit for auto stop start, they may not put in the shutoff button. So that's why.
How can you find out?
How can you find out what if there's a shutoff button?
Yes.
You just have to check the particular car you're interested in. So it's something that'll be on a given model or not. It's not something that'll be optional. Say a BMW 3 Series, it's either going to have a shutoff, a disable button or not. I think it depends on what the manufacturer needs to hit as far as their targets and, how many complaints that they've gotten from customers in the past.
So Joe, let us know what kind of car it is.
Yeah.
Yeah. I will say in Boston, stop and go, there are times where you just don't want that stuff doing its thing it just makes the car really unpleasant depending on how much it vibrates and shakes when it starts.
Yeah. It depends on the transparency, right? Yeah. Larger engines like an Aston Martin is going to be that's an event when the car goes back on.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and it depends too on how they've implemented the starter. So
right. Cause there's the e-torque thing, right?
Yeah. It's a lot less obtrusive with something like e-torque or hybrids, certainly because of the way they start the car. It's much quieter. You don't have to engage like the typical starter with like the Bendix drive and all that, it's smoother to start up that way. And then how they implement it, where if you do have the like e-torque, right, it takes off on battery power and then fires the engine once you're underway. So that feels better. And that's one of my complaints is in Boston traffic in particular, back in the before times, you'd come to a stop, but then very quickly you'd be like moving again. And so the amount of delay that's programmed into it, and you can't get it perfect for every situation. And maybe it adapts a bit as it gets used, but that's the thing that makes you want to shut it off sometimes. It's like it makes the experience so busy because you're just starting and stopping the engine so much.
Right.
And it saves some fuel, fine, but it's so aggravating.
But you know what? Also, Joe, if you have different drive modes, that may also change your experience.
Yeah.
That's
a good point.
Right. So check your, again, we don't know what kind of car it is. So check to see if you have different drive modes. That can also help with that stop start experience.
Yeah. A lot of times if there's a sport mode, that'll disable the auto stop start, things like that.
Right. Yeah. So you can kind of cheat if you don't have an actual disable button.
And, I think it should be mandatory that you have auto hold with auto stop start. So you don't have to keep your foot on the brake
You shouldn't have to keep engaging it every single time.
Yeah.
Right. Like it's like you want the vehicle to learn. Some vehicles do, they have certain settings depending upon which driver is driving that vehicle.
I guarantee you those kind of things are regulatory and we just don't know it.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Big brother. Right.
Last one, probably the most controversial one. I'm wondering what your thoughts are on the new Tesla full self-driving beta they just pushed out to a number of drivers. This really concerns me because we know it's in no way level 5 ready, and they just put it in the hands of everyday drivers with no specific training, skills, or certification. Just as an aside, I did not write this letter. I know this is from Adam Jekowenko. Anyway, continues on. I know the Tesla owners who have it are aware and signed up for it, but my problem is, as a non-Tesla driver, I didn't sign up for this. After watching just a few minutes of video posted by some users already, it's clear that if drivers didn't intervene on several occasions, there could have been serious accidents. I read that NHTSA is keeping an eye on this program and will have supposedly intervene if needed, but I just don't understand how something like this is allowed from a private company on public roads without serious government regulations and trained people at the wheel. You know, it's only a matter of time before the first person is caught sleeping at the wheel while this Tesla plows into another car. I'm sure any victim of this carelessness could sue, but I don't want to win a lawsuit. I want to not get hit by some stupid Tesla.
Wow.
Couldn't have said it better myself, Adam.
What's the matter? You got to die for progress. It's just...
Yeah. No, I mean, I think Tesla is being absolutely reckless in putting this out there and promoting it as full self-driving. It is not full self-driving. If you have to keep your hands on the wheel and eyes on the road, like they say you do, you know, I mean, in the disclaimer, when you start it, when you launch it, it says the system may do the wrong thing at the worst possible time. I mean, those exact words are in the disclaimer on your screen when you engage it.
I think my disclaimer built in when I wake up says the same thing, though. When I get up every morning, I have to accept, yes.
Yeah, no, I think, you know, unfortunately, NHTSA under the current regime in Washington is not going to do anything about this. They've completely abdicated their responsibilities when it comes to automated driving.
What is we're keeping an eye on it? Like, you're oh, I want to
for some reason.
But your job is to regulate. Not
for some
not
reason,
watch.
Regulators are not paying any attention to anything that Tesla is doing when it comes to autopilot or self-driving. And I think it's a travesty, but like Adam says, none of the rest of us signed up, or opted in to being part of Tesla's experiment. You know, I think putting this stuff in the hands of average people that haven't been trained. And I will include a link to the latest episode of the AutonoCast where Alex Roy talks a bit about his experience. Alex, among the various things he does, he works for Argo AI, and one of the things that he did last year after he started was he went through their safety operator training program, and he flunked out of it. And Alex is a professional driver. He knows how to drive. He did not pass that program that they have at Argo because, it's very stringent. There's a lot of expectations on these safety operators, and I think that, what Tesla is doing is absolutely reckless, and somebody is probably going to get killed before this is over.
Well, there's a reason why commercials always say, professional driver on a closed course.
Yeah.
Right. And I mean, it is. It's highly, highly reckless. This, no specific training, skills, or certification. That's a real thing. And I think we have to make the distinction from what Waymo is doing, because Waymo is using trained drivers.
Every other AV company is using trained operators.
Exactly. But I felt like I saw some reference to Waymo. It's like that's not the same thing at all. And so this is an issue very specific to what Tesla is doing. And it is, it's highly, highly irresponsible. It's crazy.
Yeah. Well, I think we've answered that one. I get
there. You go.
I definitely agree with all of his points. It's like their system can't even. It's only camera based. It doesn't have enough sensing to do what they're doing, and that's reckless. And it would be great if some of the regulatory bodies that are set up to regulate could actually do their job.
Unfortunately, the only federal authority that has ever called out Tesla on their irresponsible behavior when it comes to autopilot is the National Transportation Safety Board and the multiple investigations they've done of fatal crashes involving autopilot. The problem is NTSB is an investigatory body. They have no regulatory or enforcement authority. So that's up to the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration. NTSB makes recommendations. It's up to NHTSA to actually do something about it. So far, NHTSA has done nothing, and that is a disgrace. And
yes,
Elaine Chao, Secretary Elaine Chao, is a disgrace. She should not be Secretary of Transportation. But yeah, enough of politics.
Moving on.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's call that a show.
All right. Well, thanks everybody for listening, and we'll catch you next time. Keep the questions rolling in. Write us some reviews, and you know, find us where you find us. All right. Thanks.
Tell your friends.
All right. Bye.
This is the story of the one. As a maintenance engineer, he hears things differently. To the untrained ear, everything on his shop floor might sound fine, but he can hear gears grinding or a belt slipping. So he steps in to fix the problem at hand before it gets out of hand. And he knows Granger's got the right product he needs to get the job done, which is music to his ears. Call, click Granger.com, or just stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.